the theory. And we're really excited that project officially started the 1st of September, but the contract won't be signed until December. And we have 3 years, 2.5 years after that to accomplish it. But it is exciting to be working on putting into practice what is at the moment theory for us and how this actually works. Because one of the challenges of physician office reporting is time it takes to do it, and time is money. And so if we can get this process automated so that the physician doesn't have to do anything, the program triggers it, we expect to improve the reporting. And the reason that physician office reporting is essential for cancer registries is because increasingly there are more and more cases of cancer being diagnosed outside a hospital setting. And it's a biased sample. We have all had, in a number of years, prostate cancers and melanoma skin cancers that were not hospital cases. But now we're getting more breast cancers, colorectal cancer cases. And so to have the, to miss those cases will give an inaccurate picture for public health professionals and planners and program evaluators. Do you want to add a little more?
I was just thinking what a great job you're doing. Thank you.
Help just to do this from a laptop? I've got one part of
Well, the issue here is that this file isn't, I guess this is not your file, it's made a little shortcut. So it's not going, yeah, the file isn't there at all.
Do you have your memory stick?
If you have it on there, we can upload it from there.
Change order.
We can change order.
Let's change order.
Sure.
Because one of them is there.
It looks like the rest of them are here. Let's go. Do you want to move this into the last one?
That's fine. We can move.
I think I left my memory stick in the speaker ready room last night.
Okay. We have a few in there. I'll go grab before we
go. It's a 10 megabyte.
Sure.
Okay. So, Jackie, are you?
Is my motor?
Okay, let's do it from the memory stick. Okay, while Jackie is loading this, Jackie Merrill is at Columbia University, and she's a high-tech co-investigator. You know, being in a hit section when the technology fails is. I thought I'd seen it all Monday in the section I moderated on women's health, but this. Okay, here we go.
Alrighty, so.
Thanks, Jackie.
I didn't hear what you said, alright.
Methods and early findings from an evaluation of public health information exchange for public health in New York State.
I have no financial disclosures, but I am funded by. New York State and the High Tech Collaborative. Now, High Tech is a state designated entity to evaluate their HIT initiative in the state. It's a unique thing that they actually put that in. So we're going to talk about the background, discuss the methodology, and then I'll tell you some of the findings. Methodology is key here. So in New York State, despite the reputation New York State Legislature has nationally, they actually do some very far-sighted, progressive things, and one of them was they had the foresight to, in 2004, before most anyone else was thinking about it at the legislative level at the states, enacted legislation to create a 21st century health information system through this Health, Care, Efficiency, and Affordability Act for all New Yorkers. It's a multi-phase, multi-million-dollar project to bring interoperability to New York State in multiple phases. So there was an early planning stage, then a stage that involved getting the EHRs up and going through regional health information organizations, then moving that to more of a patient-centered home so the data could all be exchanged around the individual patient, and now the final stage, or at least phase 17 that's been funded so far, is to create the interoperability, so not just within a RIO there could be data exchange, but there can actually be statewide interoperability. This is what New York State looks like. These are the major regions where we've got things going. there are, you can see there's a variety of different amounts of data that get exchanged. It's pretty much focused on clinical data, ADT kind of data. Just gives you a sense of New York State, but for public health, it's included in there as a sort of a value-added proposition in the state plan. But it's a high priority value added. So in five, HEAL phase five, that's the phase that I'm evaluating and going to be talking about in this talk, they actually legislated that we would have public health interoperability, and it was done through a series of use cases. So in the call for proposals, the state asked regional health organizations to propose what they would do with a big capital grant. And people were allowed to pick a number of use cases. Several of them were clinical. And there's a public health reporting use case. So this is public health reporting, clinical data for public health reporting to improve population health. What we have in New York State is we have a public-private collaborative that is overseeing the development of the interoperability. But the interoperability itself, in terms of the statewide data exchange, is going to be a public utility, and it's called the SHINE, State Health Information Network for New York. Within this, the SHINE is a bunch of different services that allow the interoperability. The Universal Public Health Node is one of those services. So this is a way for public health to query regional health information organizations and for them to send back the data, a subset of the SHINE services. Two-way data exchange, so there can be queries from the health department, they can send data back, the health department can come back and say, I want to identify individuals, really back and forth. The idea is to get this situational awareness, which what is going on in the state, not just with outbreaks or public health things that we think about, but also for hospital beds, registries, a variety of things. So there's the specific use cases. Here's the vision. This is a very high-level vision. So you have your community health sort of like associations. This might be a vertically integrated hospital system who's then working with a regional health organization, many hospitals, moving up to, they would be able to send data through this statewide health information. So not just within themselves, but then jumping to each other. And the UPHN is located right there in the cloud. It's not really a cloud, it's a pipe. And high tech, you see the evaluation tools, and the New York State Department of Health is the one that's in charge of it. But, so that's also, I think, pretty significant that we have this, the State Department of Health being in charge. And we have a state office, the Office of Health of Information Technology Transformation. And even I think the name gives you a sense of how far ahead we are in our thinking, or at least we think we are. And then this is the statewide collaborative process, the public-private, NIAC, or NICE, we call it NICE. It's not nice, it's very nasty. But the work they do, not them, they are nice. So you get a sense of it here. Here's the use case, the functions for the Universal Public Health Node. So there's the idea of a patient query where you could ask about a specific individual. The line list query is you go in and you say, how many of these patients have you had that fit this diagnosis, influenza-like illness, whatever it may be. The ability to, once the state gets the line list query, they see that there are a number of patients of interest to them through the coded data. They say, let's go back and re-identify those people. We want to see who they are. We want a continuity of care document on them so we can see what's going on. And then there's also the possibility for the analytic query for any set of codes. How many deaths do you have in your patient database? How many of those deaths are associated with this code or that code? This is a very difficult one because of course the way people report where they actually put the code in the document, you can miss it. Time of death, for instance, may not always be death in the death field. But it's not just death they're asking about, of course. It's any kind of illness. How many children with this diagnosis amongst all children seen on a certain time period. So we have two distinct comparative case studies going on for two public health use cases. One is this HIE, public reporting for public health. The other is immunization registry. So there's two public health use cases. We have three RIOs in these locations doing interoperability, the health information exchange for public health reporting, and we have two CHITAs doing immunization reporting, connecting with, in this case of Syracuse, with the state information registry, in the case of New York City, with their city information registry. New York City is unique, as you may know, it's its own reporting district, so their city registry is akin to a state registry. And then they, in turn, report up to the NYSIS, the New York State registry. This is what we're evaluating. And this is how we decide to evaluate it. Two use cases. We wanted to look at it from the grantee side, the people who got the money to do interoperability, and from the state side, the people who are actually implementing the public utility from the state side. The research questions are here. We're using mainly qualitative methods. We don't anticipate that there'll be a lot of data exchange or even any, and I'll get to that when I tell you some of our findings. There will be, we probably will be able to get some quantitative data from the immunization people, and just in terms of users, simple descriptive data, I think, at this point. And then in the end, we'll do a comparative case study and come up with some policy-relevant things that will be relevant for New York State as it moves forward, but also with the bigger vision for state interoperability that's being planned nationwide. And since we're ahead of the game, I think we have something to offer. So we have, this is the grantee side methodology. It's a classic comparative case study where you do individual cases and then you draw conclusions comparatively. Nice, right? Makes a lot of sense. Nice, neat, tidy evaluation plan. But it's not that way. There's few outcomes that we can really find. There's not going to be real data exchange. The standards and how people are doing things are evolving, how they work with their vendors. The state itself putting forth some of the standards for exchange are evolving. And then you've got a bunch of stakeholders at all levels who have their own set of priorities and assumptions. And believe me, people do not speak the same language. So you get people in there, you've got a bunch of programmers and vendors, you've got a bunch of policymakers at the state, you've got people looking at interoperability from various levels. Extremely difficult to unweave all of this. So some of my other interests in research in general is looking at complexity and adaptive systems and some non-linear ways to evaluate. So I came up with the idea of maybe looking at it from that kind of perspective, the complex adaptive system approach. So we're taking that comparative case study and now we're going to use a number of different approaches within that, within the case study. So we're going to do a pre-state, post-state analysis. What did they say they were going to do? What were all the assumptions and decisions involved in there? And what in the end did happen? With just HEAL 5. So those HEAL 5 grantees said they were going to do something. The state gave them money to do it. What actually happened? What were they able to do? And then we also want to look at that. Where did the risk take place? So based on those assumptions, so you have assumptions, you make decisions on the assumptions. They are assumptions. Something changes. You have to go back. What's the risk involved? How did it affect the ultimate outcome? The idea is to capture some of this complexity and these nonlinear feedback loops that are going on. It's not just an A to B process. So here's one sense of here's one sense of how we're doing a risk model, and we're hoping to. There's ways you can actually calculate risk based on decisions, and so we haven't picked the exact one we're going to use yet. But you see, we're going to say, you know, this is where we started, this is what steps were taken, this is where risk went up or down. So we can kind of compare across the three regional health organizations that way. The immunization one's a little different. Now for the state side, how did the people on the state side do things that advanced interoperability even more complex? For this, we're going to try to use something that we borrow from operations, which is the idea of the feedback loop, the balancing loop that helps things go forward and that stops things, and then the reinforcing loops that help things move forward. And to help us answer this question, you know, in the context of that bigger research question, what did they do? Why was it so hard to do? And it has been hard. And I think one of the key things that I want to think about in that evaluation is this concept of undiscovered work, because that is really key to it. And that is key to the assumptions, too. You make a bunch of assumptions, somebody else has to do it, you do not know the work that's there for them to do. And so you've got a nice, beautiful timeline, and then all of a sudden you've got 6, 8, 12 months of undiscovered work that has to be done before. And this is really the story of HIE implementation. So what we've got, current state, so we have these are the three RIOs. So these are the regional health organizations. We've got different kinds of project management. Some are doing solely internal. Some are doing third party. Others are doing working very closely. So they actually have a project management group working with them, giving them staff that works there at that RIO, but they are part of an evaluation entity. A project management entity. Buffalo, Long Island, Hudson Valley. The state had to develop some specifications for the public health messaging. They were late in doing that for a variety of reasons. One of these vendors, one of these RIOs went forward and created their own solution. Then the state came up with their solution. It was different. Was there a value loss? We don't know. Did it mess with their stakeholders? And we also found in some of these that they want, they're interested in pleasing the physicians and the hospitals and the labs that are in their RIO, not so much in exchanging the data. Making that use case is critical. Buffalo's been able to do it. Very unique situation. Syracuse has been very successful in actually putting it all together, but they still haven't been able to exchange data. Why? They're waiting for their RIO to become operational. They're not going to create a solution for exchanging data with the state until their RIO does it. New York City is a unique case. I'll say no more. So here is some of the early findings. The value-added idea for the grantees is pretty critical. And the fact that public health doesn't have a clear value, and yet we still have to unravel why public health has a clear value up in Buffalo. And it does, and they're being successful with it. In fact, they have been given a non-competitive contract for HEAL 17 to move the UPHN forward. I think that will do it. So here's my final message, which is a couple of people got together and implemented this complex information exchange system here. But it's not really doing what we want it to do yet. We know it has this incredible capacity. So should we, stakeholders, stop investing in this baby? Because it's not really a fully functioning human yet. So that's what I want you to take away. Questions?
Can you remove your disc first? And remove your disc, Christina. Christina, load yours. For those of you who came in late, we have technical difficulties here, and we have to load from thumb drives. So we'll take one question from the audience while Christina loads her presentation. Your question, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, because this was all set up for a high-tech cast. So
right, the legislation, yeah.
So how are all these organizations working with the state HIEs and the RFPs
through the NICE collaborative. So NICE collaborative has gotten the high tech money for New York State, and it has a big operational plan. It was just released last week.
They're the state HIEs?
They're the coordinating body.
Okay.
Yeah, they're the coordinating body that works with the policies and is moving it forward. So that's the private public entity there.
Okay.
That it works with the actual RIOs to make it happen.
Thank you. Our next speaker, Christina Stefan, was previously introduced. Dr. Stefan is a PhD candidate in informatics at the University of Missouri Columbia. And her title is High Tech Provisions of Era, Privacy and Security Implications.
Thanks for your patience as we've worked through these interesting little adventures. I'm going to pick up right where I left off as we were muddling through. But I'd first again like to say that I have no disclosures. Just going back to the enactment of the 2009 high tech section in the ARA programs, I hope that I had said that the point was to strengthen privacy and security provisions because we knew that we were going to promote the adoption of electronic health records. Uh, Privacy breach management and response was a big part of the so-called teeth that HIPAA now has. Will you raise your hand in here if you're familiar with the breach terminology? Do I need to walk through that? Okay, so a breach, talking about protected health information, often abbreviated PHI, is the unauthorized acquisition, access, use, or disclosure of unsecured personal protected health information, or the process of it being compromised. If it constitutes a violation of HIPAA privacy rule, a risk assessment must be conducted within that organization, and we'll talk a little bit about that. While the high-tech section addressed breach issues, it addressed a number of other requirements, including the transmission of protected health information to patients, personal health records. It also looked at the handling of disclosures and accounting for disclosures. It looked at personal health records as being business associates, and also stipulated minimum data disclosure guidelines. And as we had noted previously, they also provided for the prohibition of marketing of patient data. In the event of a breach notification, the organization must, within 60 days, notify the patient and provide information about how to mitigate the potential damage or actual damage. Written details often have to go, well, they do have to go annually now to Health and Human Services. They have to go right away if there's more than 500 people involved. The new breach notification requirements bring a number of additional considerations to the organizations, and Iris will be talking more about those. In general, we're talking about increased staff training, increased awareness throughout the entire organization about the consistency of administrative and technology policy implementations to protect patient information. In the event that a risk assessment needs to be conducted, there are a number of risk assessment tools available on the internet, and you're required to review the sanctions with your employees, and at the same time, since your organization is likely to already be, unfortunately, in the limelight, you might want to review them across the entire organization. Again, making sure that you have consistent privacy and security policy and technology in place. The High-Tech Act provided guidance regarding the minimum necessary data to be exchanged and urged the creation of a statement to be made by organizations limiting the protected health information that's shared among organizations. High-Tech also provided for increased enforcement and penalties, including $10,000 to $50,000 per penalty or fine per disclosure. And in 2012, a portion of that fine will be paid to the individual. Again, so we're looking at the staffing and human resources requirements to comply with the High-Tech 2009, including the increased training and assessment of technology privacy in the organization. The need for the increased patient privacy policies and technology has created some tension between these organizations and the regulators. ONC and I believe most of the states across the U.S. would agree that we're on the right track with High-Tech 2009. We believe that stronger patient privacy protection is absolutely essential to further adoption of electronic health records and use of data. This is, of course, a priority for public health, and the federal government has actually set up a website to help consumers as well as public health employees and physicians, clinicians, providers to learn more about the provisions and their requirements. But the bottom line is that with the increased use of electronic information, the increased risk of inappropriate exposure of patient information, we do need the new provisions, and this will make the whole idea of health system transformation possible because, as I hope you would agree, it's driven by the availability of data to do quality improvement and evidence-based care. Thank you.
So, while you take your thumb drive out, Iris will load hers, and we'll take a question or two from the audience. Do we have any questions? Yes.
Question. There's also civil liability concerns with information links, correct?
Yes, absolutely there are.
Okay, now with the civil liability concerns, will that increase resistance to an appropriate internal response to say, because they know that if their internal review shows that it was their fault, they're wide open to a civil suit?
You're absolutely right, and you raise a very important point, particularly with regard to the resistance to use the electronic capabilities, health information exchanges, to implement public health data sharing, which of course would then stymie quality improvement. So where do you go from there? It's a big circle, spaghetti bowl, maybe it's a feedback loop, as Jacqueline describes, with balancing and impeding mechanisms in place as well.
Thank you. For those of you who have just come in, we had technical difficulties, so we're running a little behind. So all other questions will be held until the end. The next speaker is Iris Zachary. Iris is a certified tumor registrar, a SQL certified database administrator, and is the assistant database administrator and deals with Web Plus at the Missouri Cancer Registry, University of Missouri, and she will be talking about security. Oh, and she's also a PhD candidate in health informatics. We'll be talking about security and the new HITECH Act regulations. Is your registry ready? Iris?
And I also are the security officer for the Missouri Cancer Registry, so I have vested interest that we are actually compliant with the new regulations. When I was writing this abstract in the presentation, it was, is your registry ready? By now, it's, is your registry complying? I have no disclosures, and I will just give a very quick overview over the era, HITECH Act, More HITECH Act, HIPAA, but mainly focus on implications for the central cancer registries. ERA was signed February 17th, 2009, and we had some time to adjust and become compliant. By now, you're expected to comply. And HITECH is the subtitle of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. ERA and HITECH funding, there is money available. It looks there's a lot of money, but actually if it trickles down, there's is not as much. But we are trying to have at least a little bit for our to save a little bit for our registry and to get on the wagon when we still can. The HITECH Act, in effect, the implications for healthcare are really the incentives for the adoption of EHRs, health information exchange that benefits all, and the new privacy regulations that benefit the patients or the consumer, and really also health information technology opportunities, workforce opportunities, and opportunities for your organizations. Central registries follow what we are expected to follow is HIPAA, that was since 1996, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which mainly for us is security and privacy that's important. And also the memorandum of protection of sensitive agency information, which includes to encrypt all data on mobile devices, including all your memory sticks, all your laptops, anything that you are able to carry around. And remote access that is allowed really needs to have a two-factor authentication, meaning like you're not only signing in at one point, if you're signing into the server, you also have to have authentication. And if you have to log all your computer-readable data extracts from databases, that's running really in the background at most softwares nowadays that hold sensitive information. And ERA and high tech really expanded on, like I said, security, privacy, and the breach guidelines. For the central registry, the security standards that we have to follow are NASA, which is our national organization, National Association for American Association for Central Cancer Registries. And they provide security standards which have structural requirements, which is basically your hardware. You have to protect where your data is located on your computers. We have specific registry policy and procedures that align with HIPAA, ERA, and HITECH. And data use and release, we have regulations for that, and information technology policies and procedures. And what has been added to it is disaster recovery after Katrina. We also follow federal guidelines, which includes the VHA directive. We have specific guidelines for data that comes from our veterans hospitals. They need to be located on a partitioned side of on the computer on a partition by itself. And also when being transmitted, they are transmitted not in compliance with their regulation, which is not through Web Plus. The expanded security rules that really apply to central cancer registries is access control management, and NIST provides, that's why I included it, a really nice security checklist, which is like a starting point for you if you try to get things in place, and the web address is provided there. You have to have be in control of your device and media, meaning you have to encrypt all mobile devices, and like I said, you shouldn't really actually carrying around patient health information and on any mobile devices. But if you have laptops, the laptops need to be encrypted. You are required to provide security awareness training and incidents procedures in case there's a breach, but you're also required to bring your employees up to speed. That's the expansion is that you cannot, you're responsible for it. You're responsible and accountable for it. Like Christina mentioned, it has teeth now. So we are kind of, and the HIPAA security enforcement, the expansion is, like Christina mentioned, a lot about the breach, so I'm not going into that anymore. There is safe harbor registries and organizations that are protected under, that are excluded, are called safe harbor organizations, and you still required to notify if there's a breach, but as long as you go along with the security requirements, meaning you encrypt and you have your data protected, there is not a real breach. There was also, under HITECH, the expansion of the HIPAA requirement for the covered entities, and that you actually be prepared to investigate the breach, which also I think Christina was talking about this. And the key number is 500. Anything that touches more than 500 people, if more than 500 people are involved, definitely need to be reported. What we decided in our registry is to be proactive. We are actually documenting breaches that are not real breaches, that are potential breaches. So we have a track record of being able to see where our where the problem's happening, or where there might be like a leak, or where there might be some kind of weak link. And common issues really for breach situations are access control and management, meaning signing in and really the easy parts of security, signing in and out of computers. You need to lock your computers. Security awareness training. You have to have anybody that works for you up to speed, and the device and media control. And for us, implications for the CCR, we try to be proactive to become compliant. And at the University of Missouri, within the next year, there is a requirement to have all departments that are involved, that have patient health information involved, to undergo a security audit. We did not wait until this was happening. We actually asked for them to come and audit us. So we were able to work with the IT team from the university and look at our setup, our data, how look at our leaks, look at our programs, and they were able to perform a security audit. We have our registry works with the Registry Plus products from CDC suite, and our electronic data comes in through Web Plus, which is actually reporting over the web. So we started, they found that that was actually the most vulnerable part of our registry. So we started at to audit that first. What they found, there were 5 high security risks and a couple of medium risks. And we were actually able to work with them over a weekend, I think, and have a turnaround in 1 or 2 days and take care of those security risks. And they were able to apply that to all registries nationally. So it was benefit to us, but it was benefit to really all registries involved. And really, you need to develop an action plan. By now, it should be, you should already have an action plan, but you need to be have timely reporting if there's a breach. You need to develop a security team and a security team plan. Part of the security team, security plan is a breach team that needs to be involved. And key recommendations are really go back at your, it doesn't only have to be a registry, go back at your organization and really start at from the bottom up. We really looked at our setup, like what access doors we have, where our computers are located, who accesses them on a daily basis. And we started right there, and we actually did find some things to improve. And so you build your security team with your breach team subgroup, develop your security plan, and start with a security assessment, and if possible, an audit for your organization. Encryption, think about your data that is that is on a laptop or where your data is stored. Also, don't forget your backups. They need to be encrypted if they have any patient health information. And you need to include encryption procedures on your in a daily routine and into your training so all your employees know how to handle that. I need to speed up. So the compliance with security requirements are really look at your routines for develop and incorporate your security training. Maybe in your we have confidentiality training and for all employees at our registry, and extend your lessons learned to your business partners. We are actually working with our hospitals, and we are trying to help them to get up to speed, especially if they're a smaller hospital in a rural area. And if necessary, adapt your applications, develop any educational material with you for your business partners that are maybe not compliant. We have received last week PHI in email. So it still happens. I mean, it sounds really unbelievable, but it does happen. And make resources available for your reporting facilities. And what that all means is like more audits, but it's really, if you look at it the right way, then it's really to your benefit. And the enforcement is there, so we can actually work with it. There's tougher fines, accountability, and you have to have copies of your records, meaning you have to record any breach. And whenever possible, they work with a minimum data set, and there are marketing restrictions. So in conclusions, central cancer registries are really established data repositories. Like Randy said, we are doing this for quite some time. And you can become like the leader in high-tech compliance at your organizations. And central cancer registries are an effective and efficient data source for a wide range of public health data. Therefore, we want to be in compliance. So this is just my acronyms for.
Thank you. Iris, if you take yours out and put mine in, and we'll take one question while we're doing this.
I'm a physician, so I'm from Wales. So that might be a challenging position. My question is, if I have a secure Google ID, email ID, not the regular, and an iPhone,
We do not. The question was from a physician who says he has a secure ID, his iPhone, and Google, we do not accept in the Missouri Cancer Registry anything coming in through email. It's we may be over restrictive, but that. Yeah, and we know that it makes physicians' lives easier. You have to make the determination. We're not going to say.
My question to the experts is, are we following the rules? Am I following the rules if I do that?
If your information is encrypted and you've taken all of those steps and there is a breach, it is absolutely not an actionable breach, so to speak. So is it splitting hairs?
It's not
enough. Is it at risk for further action? I'd be hesitant to say as another physician to you. And would refer to my
tools.
The keyword is encryption.
So the
two passwords aren't sufficient.
Right, a simple email is not encrypted.
Okay. For those of you who came in late, we had technical problems, so we're having to load, so we're running a couple of minutes late. I'm Jeanette Jackson-Thompson, Director of the Missouri Cancer Registry, Research Associate Professor in Health Management and Informatics, and the PI on a new project. From EHRs to MCR. I'll be talking about the challenges and opportunities for central cancer registries, ERA, eHealth, and comparative effectiveness research in supporting achievement of public health goals. No relationships. The learning objectives for my presentation today are to describe how CCRs facilitate and enable CER, to describe strategic planning considerations regarding the role of CCRs in enabling CER, and describe operational considerations and recommendations. Alphabet soup. I think you've heard all of these terms already today, so I'm going to be focusing on central cancer registries and comparative effectiveness research. MoHiTech is the Missouri version of HiTech. The purpose of what we were doing is to identify CER challenges and opportunities and develop an action plan for our central registry. as you've already heard, ERA legislation really significantly impacts central registries with the HIPAA privacy and security provisions. And the positive impact is funding. For expanding registries beyond public health surveillance, which all NPCR-funded registries are focused on public health surveillance. The NCI-funded SEER registries are more fortunate. They have funding to do follow-up and survival, not just be incidence registries. So the purpose of CER appropriations under ERA are to evaluate the relative effectiveness of different healthcare services and treatment options and encourage the development and use of clinical registries, clinical data networks, and other forms of electronic data to generate outcomes data. And Wendy, would you be my timekeeper? The importance of CER is to support and enable better decisions about health use of healthcare resources. And this can lead to improvement in the public's health, and it is expected to reduce the cost of care. That's our great hope. National CER priorities specifically address public health and social justice goals. And much has been published about the roles of HIT, HIE, and CER in transforming the healthcare system and achieving better health outcomes. So you've heard of the results of some of the review that we've done of high tech, and we talked with the Mo High Tech contacts. We reviewed their documents. They can be found online. And the goal of Mo High Tech is to implement EHR and HIE, which will improve quality and reduce cost of delivery by 2014. And the Department of Health Management Informatics Chair, Dr. Grant Savage, is the PI on a large grant, a regional assistance center grant, to provide technical assistance to physician offices and critical access hospitals and community hospitals that will be converting to EHRs that meet the standards. And we are trying to piggyback onto that. The question that came about cost, and if we can get written into the contract with vendors that will be working on this project, that they must report to the cancer registry, or must have the interface to report to the cancer registry, and cancer is a reportable condition in Missouri, we think that that will be a big move forward, and we won't be faced with that issue, hopefully, of cost. We conducted a literature review of the best practices and looked at registry-based research. We viewed Central Cancer Registry websites that we knew were doing good work, and we identified potential models and sources of information. We distilled and incorporated all this information and engaged in strategic planning, looking at our operations and our future. And we have spent, since from 1996 when we received NPCR funding until about 2005, we spent building a high-quality database. And after we had done that, then we began to look at, beyond public health surveillance, what can a central cancer registry do, and how can its data be used to greater effectiveness? And so we began to engage in research. I hope that I'm making an accurate statement that effective January 1, 2011, we will no longer be the Missouri Cancer Registry, we will be the Missouri Cancer Registry and Research Center, MCR-ARC. That was part of our strategic planning. We had several name suggestions, but ARC won out. It's simple, it's easy. MCR is our brand, but ARC, that positive, you know, this ARC that we're going from here to there, it's positive. So we're excited about that. We developed specific plans and actions, and these are specific to our registry, but they are can be adopted by other registries. And as been previously mentioned, think beyond the specific. Much of what we do applies not just to cancer registries, it applies to all registries, and it can apply to other types of programs that deal with protected health information and where you want to measure outcomes. We need to evolve with the e-health environment. We hope to serve as a resource for innovative data sharing and research, and be ready to support new initiatives, such as CER. So state and national level planning documents emphasize registries as key data repositories in HIE. And we can accelerate CER efforts. Our action plan, we switched from a commercial commercial central registry product to CDC's Registry Plus suite of products, and in so doing, we saved over $100,000 a year, which we could then use for other purposes. We participate in CDC and NACER work groups. We do quite a bit of beta testing for the Registry Plus suite of products. And the advantage of having staff such as Iris and our database manager, Saba Yamani, is that we can debug problems and propose solutions. And we like to be the innovators and be there on the cutting edge. It puts a little more stress on our staff, but we get they listen to us, and if we know that there's something that we need, it may get moved up a little bit in the chain. So that's exciting. We identify potential research that we can collaborate with. For example, we just finished a five-year NCI R01 study with Mario Schutman at Washington University in St. Louis, looking at the neighborhood impact on quality of life of breast cancer survivors. We identified 1,200 women from the Cancer Registry database, consented them. 1,164 were interviewed simultaneously, women without breast cancer matched by area of residence and age group and in three areas by race, were interviewed 1 year post-diagnosis and 2 years post-diagnosis. And we are now looking at is the impact of where you live on your quality of life. It goes beyond, you know, once you've got cancer, you've got it. Whatever stage you were diagnosed, you were diagnosed. But the quality of life after that may depend on your access to care, your ability to get follow-up treatment, the safety, being able to walk and exercise and have good nutrition. We conduct additional linkages, such as with the Breast and Cervical Cancer Control Program, the National Death Index. We're looking at the Social Security Death Index and other databases to improve the quality of our race and ethnicity data and the quality of the and completeness of our treatment data. And we write grants. Cancer Registry should facilitate efforts involving analyses and presentation of existing data. On a national level, CDC's Cancer Planet and Environmental Public Health Tracking Network are good examples. Our website, we have links to all of those, to the Missouri Department of Health's Missouri Information for Community Assessment, MICA, and we actually produce the data, the tables that are behind the Cancer Incidence MICA, and it's just loaded on their website. But on our website, we have the top 10 cancers by race, the top 10 cancers for each sex and both sexes for every one of the 115 counties in Missouri where we have sufficient numbers. A few counties, we only have the top three because patient confidentiality, the small numbers prohibit it. And we do a visual display of data, such as using Atlas, which was here. And at the same time we do all of these other activities, we must continue to protect patient privacy, maintain the security of patient and provider data, and maintain the quality of our data. And why? Because the continued public trust is essential. If we don't have the trust of the public, we are not going to get all the data, even though it's mandated by law. The reason that we get good data is because the cancer patients trust us, the providers trust us. And in conclusion, Central Registry is well positioned to develop secure, innovative techniques for linking data from multiple databases, to engage holders of large data sets such as health insurers, healthcare providers, and systems. But our challenge is to maintain data quality while we increase the quantity of data that is available. Thank you very much, and I apologize for all of the technical problems that we have encountered.
And we are now going to move rapidly into those five key points, and then that will be your turn, your time to ask your questions and to engage in dialogue. To save time, I'm reading all of them. Wendy's is to leverage scarce resources and think beyond content. Think of similar processes and actions, and we will get more results from our scarce resources in that case. Christina, HIT and HIE are necessary elements of health system transformation. Public trust is essential and necessarily supported by privacy and security.
JACI, Health Information Exchange, HIE for Public Health is in its infancy, and stakeholders need to make the investment to bring it up, bringing up the baby. And I'm so envious of you being in New York and having had that advance opportunity. IRIS wants you to remember breach team, build and develop your security team, and that your employees, maybe your greatest security risk, those little things that we just forget to do. And mine is always remember that our basic function is to collect the best data we can and to serve the people of whatever community, state, region we represent to the best of our ability, and to always protect the privacy of individuals, and remember that behind every bit of data there is a human being, and we must remember those human beings, and we work together to reduce health disparities and improve the health of all. Thank you. Yes, question number one here.
Flash drives, how are you handling flash drives as a we're using them, of that being a security breach?
We do not have patient information on flash drives. That is not allowed.
Right, but if you stick one in, that's opening up an avenue into the computer.
Does anyone want to address that?
If you stick one in your computer?
Sure.
You download?
Well,
anybody that, it would be only anybody that works at the, I can only speak for the registry, people that have access to our data are employees of the registry.
We have the double system that we have no protected health information that can be accessed from the computer where we're sticking it in. You have a separate login to get into any protected health information.
We also have moved to all of our data is now only at the server level. There's no patient data at your hard drive. You cannot save any data to your hard drive.
So
even if you stick it in, you don't have the access.
So, no. For those of you, and for the recording, no data resides on hard drives. Data resides on the server. White shirt, you had the next question.
Yeah, the comment to that. My name is Howard Gates. I work at the Indian Health Service Federal Agency. Indian Health Service. Basically, if a flash drive goes in one of our computers, it gets encrypted. No questions asked. It gets encrypted. So my question is, do you guys use a master person index or master patient index that you guys manage in order to resolve any duplicate stuff that you may be getting from different places, or do you subscribe to an API?
Oh, no. Yeah, we have the software that we use, Registry Plus, and Iris might want to speak more in detail to this. When a new case comes in, it'll say, hey, Mary Smith, we already have Mary. Is this the same Mary Smith? Yes, no. And if it's the same Mary Smith, is it the same primary? And we are contractors to the Missouri Department of Health. The names, the PHI, remain in the Missouri Cancer Registry. They do not have access to the confidential patient information. We give them, when we send data to NACER and for certification and to CDC for publication in or uploading on United States Cancer Statistics, that's a de-identified data set. That same de-identified data set goes to the Department of Health. But no names, no confidential identifiers. The only time the Department of Health gets any confidential identifiers is when we're conducting a cancer inquiry, a report of excess cancer, and we are dealing with specific individuals in a specific neighborhood where there is a specific environmental risk that is suspected.
Yeah. Data is not having the same information on two different
Right, right. One patient may have two tumors, but there will be only one patient.
And this is where our length of service has done us a disservice, is we're so good at manually linking, we have not taken advantage of, and we have sophisticated programs, so we're not doing it by hand, but we aren't up to speed yet on looking at the master patient indices that the Rios and the central areas are looking at. So, all right, NPCR, I'm not supposed to, you know, okay, so. NPCR is looking at these kind of things on behalf of the Inter Cancer Registry organization to see how we can contribute and how we can take advantage of a central location to improve what we're doing and save some resources. But we're behind the curve on that.
There was another question over here. I would just like to follow up on that, and all 45 registries in the state registries in the District of Columbia funded by NPCR are required to have case-sharing agreements with their bordering states, and Missouri has 8, and are encouraged to have case-sharing agreements with other states where their residents are maybe diagnosed or treated. And so we have 12 additional case-sharing agreements. And so if a resident of Missouri is diagnosed or treated in Kansas, that will come back to us, and vice versa. We check to see if we have any state that has more than 10 residents that are diagnosed in our state and we don't have a case-sharing agreement with that state, we will notify that state and ask if they want to engage in a case-sharing agreement. We do not have the same problem that New York, New Jersey, and Florida has, where you have people with dual residences. They spend we have a minor problem. They have a major problem. And they have worked, and we have two people here from New York. I don't know, Chris, whether you want to comment on that, about how they have worked to see whether we are counting the same patient twice, because someone may be a resident of New York and a resident of Florida and may be counted twice for the same tumor, and we're really working to eliminate that.
Jeanette, I'll have to jump in again and say Minnesota does not participate in the data sharing agreement. Our state law is more restrictive, and so we are not allowed to. And so they're, you know, it's there, most are doing it, but there's exceptions in every rule, and we get to be one of them.
And Mayo Clinic is, yes.
On the whole topic of breaches or reporting of breaches, issues with this, have you run across venues where there can be sharing and learning based on, you know, anonymized reporting of that, that then another organization can say, well, that was a breach, I need to go protect myself from that breach?
In those kinds of environments, my experience has been that we have made up our data. So I've not been in that kind of environment where you've actually anonymized the data and you're using real data. I'm sorry, I can't speak directly to that, but
would just be helpful at, I don't know if that's a regional or national level, where you could begin to share this sort of information.
Well,
I think, if I'm wrong, I think he's talking more about sharing experience, like this is how we were breached.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I can address that a little bit. Our CTRs show up early for work, and one morning we received a file, and the reporting facility had intended to send it to the central registry and had sent that file to everyone on their email, the all button. It was all hospitals, and so we immediately sent out an email saying, do not open the file you have just received. Destroy immediately. That was not a breach that we created, but it was a very good learning tool, a very good lesson for our reporting facilities, that you need to create a separate, you cannot send patient identification where there is a list that could be, the wrong button could be hit. But that's a great idea. And we subscribe, Nancy Cole, operations manager of the registry, gets several federal publications that are really good. And that's where we've learned a lot about the breaches that have been made, like the VA laptop, and which shut down VA reporting in every central registry. We were one of only 8 states that were able to initially reestablish that, and that was because we'd worked with all 3 VA hospitals in Missouri for a number of years. We had a level of trust there, and as soon as CDC and the VA admitted that they weren't going to be able to reach an agreement after a year, and we were given permission to go forward, we moved forward, worked with the regional attorney for the VA system, and got a new data transfer agreement in place. And as Iris mentioned, we had to change the way we brought in the data and the way we stored the data, the way we edited the data to comply with the VA requirements. But we got the data. Are there any other questions? I feel like I've hogged. With the panel, do any of you have any last minute thoughts? Christina. Speak up, please, or come up to the podium.
To the gentleman who recommended a breach forum, so to speak, would you be interested in trying to help develop that? I can think off the top of my head a couple of organizations who might be interested in taking the lead. Wendy here has recommended the Public Health Data Standards Consortium. I'm also thinking of AMIA and Health Information Management. It's sort of the HIMSS counterpart. AHIMA, thank you.
I didn't know something like that already even existed. Or was
federally,
that
does.
Federally it does, but not at the state.
For the breaches that are over the 500, the key number 500, they are actually on the on our website. And I can get that to you if because I've heard about that. They have to be disclosed.
Thanks, Iris. That's a good idea. Yeah.
I mean, anything between 1 and 500 is still a breach, so I think it's worthwhile sharing and learning.
We can have more than just sort of the reporting, then if you have forums where you can begin to say, here's how that happened.
Like lessons learned.
Yeah, that's a great.
The way we distribute information, we have a newsletter that goes to every reporting hospital in Missouri, but it also goes to all other central cancer registries. And several other registries do the same thing. And so we have news, lessons learned. The cancer registry community is a very small community, and we always are operating with scarce resources. We don't like to reinvent the wheel, so we adopt and adapt and make the most of whatever someone has found out. We're a very sharing community. Jackie, you have are the one. Do you have anything you'd like to add? Well, I think we have, we're right on schedule. Does anyone have one last question or one last comment?
I have one comment.
Hi, Chris. I'm glad you're here. I, being that this is a HIT section, I wanted to talk very briefly about one more initiative that APHA has taken, and that is in creating an action plan for consumer engagement in health information. Chris, if you'd like to say a little bit more about that, the reason I bring it up is because sincerely, APHA is at the center of consumer engagement and health information exchange adoption. Privacy and security of our data is absolutely essential, as we've already emphasized. And if you're interested in all at contributing to this effort, it will only grow larger. And there's so much work to be done. Please share your name, email, contact information with us so that we can add you to our distribution list. Thank you.
And if you're not a member of the HIT section already, please join.
There was a meeting on early this year, back in October. We're actually just getting everything together right now, kind of as a follow-up. And for HIT members and individuals that are interested, we'll be releasing some information. But that's not something that we're at the point of really releasing at this time, but there are some good things along the lines of consumer engagement. As that's out there as far as consumer informatics. If you've attended any of the sessions on consumer informatics, that's something that's very important. We know that the consumer is definitely the end user, the true end user of the health information. So that's something that is very important and that HIT is actually very interesting.